Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine you're scrolling through the scientific news and you read about a remarkable genetic discovery, maybe a gene region that explains why humans in a specific place evolved to resist certain diseases or, you know, digest new foods. It's often presented as pretty solid evidence, like this is recent human adaptation, case closed. But here's the slightly unsettling question. How many times do we see these findings only for the next big study to come along and, well, quietly raise some doubts about that same result?
Yeah, it happens more often than we'd probably like to admit. And the issue isn't always the biology itself. Often, it's actually a failure in the statistics. Think about it. Mm-hmm. When you scan the entire human genome, looking through billions of data points for signs of evolution, you're running thousands upon thousands of statistical tests. Look. And these tests, they're not independent, they're correlated.
Right, because nearby bits of the genome tend to be inherited together.
Exactly. And if you skip that really critical, sometimes tedious step of mathematically correcting for all those related tests, well, you just swing the door wide open for false positives.
So what looks like this incredibly strong, undeniable proof of positive selection and adaptive sweep might actually just be statistical noise, amplified because you look so many times.
That's the statistical trap, precisely. Uh-huh. And it's why this deep dive today is, I think, really important. The methods we've been using to find very recent selection, especially the ones based on these shared ancestry segments, well, they've often relied on kind of simplified or even ad hoc thresholds.
Meaning not rigorously derived?
Often, yeah. This lack of really strict statistical grounding has probably inflated the list of reported recent human adaptations.
Okay, so this new research offers a way to clean that up, a more rigorous mathematical tool.
That's the core idea. It could potentially cut the list of validated recent adaptations, maybe even in half, especially in some really diverse populations.
But you mentioned a twist earlier. What's the really intriguing part?
Yes. Here's where it gets fascinating. What if some of the most famous, the most seemingly undeniable selection signals, the ones that pop up as significant in people across different continents, different ancestry groups, what if they aren't actually adaptations at all?
What else could they be?
What if those shared signals are more like a genomic mirage caused by something, well, maybe less exciting than adaptive evolution, something more structural or molecular? That's the real tension we need to unpack today. But first, we really should take a moment to acknowledge the researchers here. We're celebrating the work of Seth D. Temple and Sharon R. Browning. Their work significantly pushes forward our ability to apply really stringent statistical methods to identity by descent or IBD segment analysis for detecting this recent positive selection.
And they use data from some big players, right?
Absolutely. Their findings rely heavily on data from major consortia, including the Transomics for Precision Medicine Project, that's TUP Med, and also the huge UK Biobank, or UKBB, massive data sets.
Okay, so let's back up a bit. Remind us, what's the main goal when scientists do a selection scan? What are they trying to find?
Fundamentally, the goal is to pinpoint where positive natural selection, you know, adaptive evolution, has actually been at work in our recent past. We want to find those specific genetic changes that helped our ancestors survive better, maybe fight off pathogens or adapt to new climates or diets. It's crucial for understanding our history and even disease resistance today.
But you said the statistics have been tricky. What was the problem with older methods?
Historically, it's been a challenge. A lot of the older methods relied on what we call ad hoc summary statistics.
Ad hoc again. So they give you a score, maybe? Like, how weird is this region?
Sort of, yeah. Mm. They output a number suggesting how unusual a genetic region looks compared to the background, but often they don't produce a formal value. And without that value, it's really hard to do proper multiple testing correction across the whole genome.
So what did researchers do? Just pick a number?
Sometimes, yeah. Or they defaulted to the standard threshold from a different kind of study, genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, that famous $5 times 10 and 8 number.
Ah, okay. But you're saying that number isn't right for this kind of analysis.
Exactly. It's fundamentally inappropriate here. The GWAS threshold was calculated based on the correlation structure of common genetic variants, typically from older genotyping arrays. But in this study, we're looking at identity by descent rates, IBD rates. The whole statistical landscape, the correlation structure, it's completely different.
How is it different? Why does that matter so much?
Well, IBD analysis focuses on sharing these long stretches of chromosomes that people inherit intact from a fairly recent common ancestor. If you share a long segment with someone, it means not just one marker, but the entire surrounding region is likely shared and thus highly correlated within that group of people.
Okay, so it's not like independent coin flips across the genome.
Not at all. A standard GWAS might assume independence between distant markers. But here, the data points the IBD rates along a chromosome are highly dependent. Think of them like beads on a string. Pulling one influences its neighbors. You need a statistical model that gets that genetic memory along the physical chromosome.
And getting it wrong has consequences.
Big consequences. Declaring a gene is under strong selection gets a lot of attention. It can even have societal impacts if it's misinterpreted, or worse, misappropriated.
Right, you have to be really careful.
Which is why Temple and Browning chose the most stringent approach, controlling the family-wise error rate, or FWER.
FWER. Let's break that down for the listener. That means they want the chance of making even one false positive claim across the entire genome scan to be really low, right? Like less than 5%.
Exactly. It's about controlling the overall rate of false discoveries across all the tests you perform. It's a very conservative, statistically rigorous standard. You're setting the significance bar very high to avoid crying wolf.
And the specific signal they're using to find selection is this IBD sharing.
Yes. They're looking for an excess of IBD sharing, particularly long segments. Let's say segments that are 2 centimorgans or longer. If you see many individuals in a population sharing the same long chunk of DNA around a specific gene, it suggests that a beneficial version of that gene, a haplotype, was favored by selection and spread really rapidly. That's the classic signature of a recent selective sweep happening maybe in the last few hundred generations.
So the big challenge was how to set that FWR control significance bar correctly, given the tricky correlation structure of IBD data.
Precisely. Doing simulations for every single analysis would be computationally brutal, taking weeks or months. They needed a more efficient mathematical way.
And that's where this Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process comes in. Sounds a bit complex.
It does, but the concept is actually quite elegant for this problem. They modeled the standardized IBD rates along the genome using this OU stochastic process.
Okay, why does that model work here? What does it capture?
Well, think about what happens to IBD segments over generations. Recombination breaks them down, right? So even if a region have high IBD sharing due to selection, as you move further away along the chromosome, that sharing rate will tend to drop back down towards the average background level. The OU process is often used in physics or finance to model things that fluctuate randomly, but are always pulled back towards a central mean. That reversion to the mean over physical distance along the chromosome is exactly what the OU process models very efficiently. It captures that dependency, that genomic memory.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense. It reflects the biological reality of recombination breaking things up over distance.
Exactly. And because it captures that correlation structure mathematically, they could move beyond guesswork or those super intensive simulations.
So how did they use the model to set the threshold?
The OU model allowed them to derive two new precise FWER controlling thresholds. One is a quick analytical approximation, a formula based on work by Siegmund and Yakir. The other is a simulation approach, but one based directly on simulating the OU process itself, which is much faster than simulating whole genomes.
So two ways to get a mathematically solid significance level for the whole genome scan, aiming for that strict 5% FWER.
That was the goal, yes. A rigorous way to find the right multiple testing quantile.
Did it work? Did this new approach actually improve their ability to detect real selection signals?
It definitely provided a boost in statistical power.
Yeah.
Because the method adapts to the actual correlation structure in the genome, rather than making overly simple assumptions like, say, a Bonferroni correction, which assumes independence.
Which we know isn't true for IBD.
Right. They found it could increase statistical power by up to 10% compared to Bonferroni. And their simulations showed good power, too. The scan using IBD segments of 2 centimorgans or longer, $2 on CMAMR, had over 50% power to detect fairly strong selective sweeps, those with selection coefficients, X of 0.01 or greater, especially when the selected allele reached intermediate frequencies.
Okay, so it's better at finding real signals, but I remember reading a potential catch in the paper, specifically about that most powerful scan, the $2 and Cineman one.
Yeah.
Something about it being anti-conservative.
Yes. That's the important statistical nuance we need to cover. It turned out that for that specific scan, the FWR control wasn't quite perfect. The empirical FW, or the actual rate of false positives they observed in simulations, was a bit inflated.
How inflated?
By more than 150%, actually. So instead of achieving the target 0.05 level, the actual false positive rate was closer to 0.098, almost double.
Wow. So the test that was best at finding true signals was also letting in significantly more false signals than intended.
Kind of, yes. It highlights a challenge. The authors suggest this happens because the distribution of IBD rates in that very sensitive scan might have a heavier tail than the normal distribution the OU model assumes.
Meaning the really extreme high IBD sharing values were even more extreme than the model predicted.
Exactly. Those rare super high sharing events occurred slightly more often than expected under the model, causing the calculated threshold to be just a tiny bit too low, leading to more false positives than the target 5%. Conversely, the scan using longer segments, $3 in a centimeter, was actually conservative, fewer false positives than expected.
Interesting trade-off. But even with that slight issue in the 2CM scan, the overall approach seems much more rigorous than what was done before, especially when they applied it across different populations.
Absolutely. The real power of this rigorous approach became clear when they compared it to the older heuristic methods used in previous studies. For years, people often used a simple rule of thumb. If a locus had an IBD rate that was, say, 4 standard deviations above the median, it was flagged as potentially selected.
Just a simple cutoff.
Right. And what Temple and Browning found was that this simple rule might have been just barely okay for populations with relatively lower genetic diversity, like the Topmed European ancestry cohort they looked at, EUR1.
But not for others.
But it failed quite dramatically for populations with deeper histories and higher diversity, specifically the African ancestry populations they analyzed. That 4 standard deviation rule was simply not stringent enough.
How big was the difference when they applied their new OU-based thresholds?
It was really stark. In one of the African ancestry cohorts, using that old heuristic flagged 24 distinct loci as significant, 24 potential adaptation signals.
Okay. And with the new method?
After applying the new, mathematically derived OU-based correction, that number plummeted. Depending on the specific cohort, it dropped down to only 4 or maybe 10 loci.
Wow, from 24 down to 4 or 10, that's a massive reduction.
It really is. It's a powerful demonstration that the old rule of thumb was just too lenient, especially in populations with higher genetic diversity. And possibly also populations with complex internal structure that wasn't fully accounted for, which can also inflate IBD sharing locally.
So it underlines that this statistical rigor isn't just like a nice to have, it's essential.
It's absolutely essential, particularly when studying populations with deep, complex demographic histories. You need methods that can handle that complexity properly.
So after applying this much stricter filter, which well-known selection signals still made the cut, did the famous ones hold up?
Many of the classic examples did, yes. In the European ancestry populations, the method still clearly picked up the strong signal at the LCT2 of the locus, that's for lactase persistence, digesting milk into adulthood.
A textbook case.
Absolutely. Also, the huge major histocompatibility complex, the MHC RE region, vital for immune function, and other interesting regions like the OAC gene cluster, the TLRS gene cluster, which have signatures potentially linked to adaptive introgression, getting beneficial genes from Neanderthals or Denisovans.
And in the non-European groups?
In the African ancestry cohorts, strong signals remained at the HBB2O locus, that's hemoglobin, famously linked to malaria protection and sickle cell trait. And also, TAE2R11 fold involved in bitter taste perception.
Yeah.
In the UK, biobank participants of Indian British ancestry, LC2R0ECO, also showed up as significant. So known strong signals generally replicated.
Okay, so it confirms the strong signals, but significantly cleans up the maybe weaker or potentially false ones.
That's a good summary. And this leads to one of the biggest implications of the study. Temple and Browning aren't just giving us a better statistical filter. They're effectively helping to redefine what might constitute a detectable selective sweep using these methods.
How so?
They suggest that selection events with coefficients less than 0.01, meaning selection pressure that's relatively weak, might simply be too faint to leave a reliable IBD signature that survives these rigorous multiple testing corrections.
So it sets a kind of practical limit, a benchmark for the strength of selection we can realistically hope to find with this approach.
Exactly. It gives us a better handle on the inherent limitations and power of these scans. But the most provocative part, the real twist that makes you rethink things, comes from looking at the signals that seem the strongest and most widespread.
Ah, right. The ones that showed up across multiple continents.
Yes. There were 2 specific genomic regions that hit genome-wide significance even with the new corrections in African, European, and Indian British ancestry groups. These are on chromosome bands 16q12.3, which includes the gene 6YLT11, and 22 kilo of M&$21.
Okay, wait. A signal that strong showing up independently in three diverse, geographically separated populations. That sounds like the definition of a really important shared human adaptation, doesn't it? That must be real selection.
That would certainly be the most exciting interpretation. And it was the initial assumption. But the authors dug deeper and challenged this view. They look at the physical structure of these specific genomic regions.
And what did they find?
They point out that both 16q12.3 and 22q11.21 are known genomic hotspots. They're regions notorious for being highly variable, prone to recurrent copy number variations, CNVs, and large deletions or duplications. They are structurally unstable parts of our genome.
Okay, so they're not typical stable regions. How does that affect the IBD signal?
Well, the authors argue that these shared signals are actually unlikely to be independent, parallel cases of recent positive adaptation. Instead, they propose that the high IBD rates seen there are more plausibly explained by the molecular behavior caused by these structural variants.
Can you explain that mechanism? How does structural instability mimic positive selection?
It's thought that the presence of these large structural variations, like CNVs, can locally suppress recombination. Basically, the cellular machinery that normally shuffles DNA during meiosis finds it harder to cross over cleanly in these structurally complex regions.
Ah, so the chromosome segments don't get broken up as easily there.
Exactly. Or, alternatively, there might even be selection against recombinant chromosomes in these regions because they might be dysfunctional. Either way, reduced recombination or selection against recombinants. The result is that large haplotypes containing these structural variants tend to stay intact for longer periods, passed down through generations.
And that looks just like?
It looks just like a selective sweep. You get an excess of long, shared IBD segments purely because of the physical structure and recombination properties of the region, not necessarily because of positive selection on a specific gene within it. It's essentially a molecular or structural artifact mimicking adaptation.
That is a really significant reframing. So we could be looking at what appears to be a powerful shared adaptation across humanity, but it might just be a quirk of how our chromosomes behave in these unstable zones, a kind of technical artifact.
That seems to be the more plausible explanation for these specific shared signals, according to the authors. It's a huge cautionary tale. It forces us to look much more critically at any signal found in these known structurally variable regions.
It certainly changes how you'd interpret future results. Are there other limitations to keep in mind?
Well, as we discussed, there's the slight anti-conservatism of the $2 CM on scans FWA control that needs refinement. And importantly, even with these advanced corrections, unaccounted for population substructure within cohorts, especially diverse ones like the TopMed African ancestry group, can still potentially inflate IBD sharing and create false signals. So careful sample selection and correction for structure remain crucial.
But the core methodological advance holds.
Yes, the move towards mathematically modeling the correlation structure with things like the OU process represents a major step forward in rigor.
Okay, let's try to boil this down. What's the main take-home message for someone listening?
I'd say the first point is that the hunt for recent adaptation using these haplotype or IBD-based scans absolutely requires mathematically sound multiple testing corrections like the OU-based ones discussed here. Otherwise, you risk drowning in false positives.
And applying these stricter methods really does change the landscape.
It does. It significantly trims down the list of candidate sweeps, showing that older, simpler rules were often far too permissive, especially in genetically diverse non-European populations.
And the most critical, maybe unsettling, finding.
That some of the most prominent signals, especially those showing up across multiple diverse groups, like the ones on chromosome 16 and 22, need extreme scrutiny. They're very likely artifacts of underlying genomic structural variation, not examples of widespread recent positive selection.
Which leaves us with a big question going forward.
Absolutely. It really forces us to ask. Now that we're more aware that these structural artifacts can perfectly mimic adaptive sweeps, how can future studies get better at telling the difference? How do we reliably separate true adaptive evolution from these tricky genomic mirages?
A crucial question for the field. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.